May 22nd, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, a special edition from the 2013 Cannes Film Festival. Rather than record our normal weekly episode, we decided to do a Cannes episode, I guess, because Michael is in a different time zone and we're 6 hours ahead here in Cannes. And I'm with Stephen Garrett from... Well, Stephen, why don't you explain who you're with? I don't know whether to say you're with Jump Cut or you're here covering for the New York Observer.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I, for many years, have been coming as a journalist, fortunate enough to come as a journalist. And then also I have been slowly and steadily building a business doing movie trailers for foreign language films, art house films, documentaries, things like that. So it's actually quite handy for me to come for both those reasons.
Now, we're also with one of our listeners, Andrew Einsbrook, who's a producer from Australia, yet he is originally from Texas, who is here in Cannes. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a thrill to be here.
Could you do an Australian accent?
Very badly.
Okay.
G'day, mate.
All right, there you go. That's better than me.
You could be an actor in, well, actually, maybe Baz Luhrmann's movie, which opened the festival.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So, but there's really no use talking about it because it opened in the States first and didn't receive positive reviews, made a boatload of money.
That's right. So it's a success.
It's a success. Financially, not a success for Cannes.
No, I think it's a success for Cannes. I think it's a perfect opening night film in that it's very festive and brings a lot of celebrities and is not awful.
Okay.
Which, as you know, many opening night films have been really unwatchable. and this was at least fun. And you know, there's a certain poetry to it because... You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote Gatsby something like 20 miles away from Cannes, and there's a certain history there, and so it's very apt.
Okay.
And it's certainly going to be Baz's highest grossing film ever. So from that point of view, it's a success. He'll get to make the next one.
That's a good point. You know, Baz Luhrmann opened Moulin Rouge here in 2001, so certainly he's no stranger to Cannes. That was the opening film on Wednesday, March 15th, so it's been a week since we've been here. Feels more like,
a month.
A lot longer. Especially when you're watching movies like Ellie, which...
That's right. Helly? You say Ellie?
I don't know. I've heard it pronounced...
I guess it's Mexican, so...
Yes.
Ellie.
It was directed by Amat Escalante.
It was.
And I think that's probably all we want to say about that film.
Well, no, apparently he's a protege of Carlos Regattas, and it shows in the filmmaking, which is really very derivative. I mean, it's
really? Because I've never seen Flaming Testicles.
Well, that's new. Yeah, that made me gasp with delight. Any sort of extremities being immolated like that. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of torture in it. There's a lot of violence. It's about police corruption and, you know, basically oppression of the poor. In modern-day Mexico, would you say?
Yes. I mean,
what other things is it trying to address?
I think that's pretty much it.
It's kind of a hell on earth. There's a sort of inferno-type thing going on, too, right? Isn't there a quote at the beginning of the film that talks about that?
I think so, but frankly, the best part of the movie was when you leaned over to me during the torture scene and said, well, something was on fire at that point. We'll just leave it at that. And you said, I can't believe Steven Spielberg is going to have to sit through this.
Yeah, watching a guy set another man's penis on fire.
Right.
It's pretty intense. I mean, you know, there is craftsmanship behind the camera. There is a sense of there's an eye there, and I guess there's a certain agenda. So I can't completely dismiss it out of hand, but it just felt very familiar. You know, if I were to make an art house film and try to get into competition in Cannes, it would probably be Helly. And that's not praise. I mean, that's literally like there's a sort of paint by numbers kind of dimension to it. You know what I mean? Like, we'll set this guy's dick on fire and, you know, we'll have really long takes of things and we'll just beat people up and brutalize.
Usually out of a car window.
Maybe rape a girl repeatedly off screen, you know. Anyway.
Speaking of raping a girl. Okay, so that brings us to François Ozon's film, French filmmaker, and that was Young and Beautiful, Jeune et Jolie, which was about a young and beautiful woman, girl, 17, who I guess is experiencing her sexual freedom for the first time and decides one way to do that would be to, you know, become a prostitute.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, she's never raped.
She's never raped.
I mean, there is another rape later in the festival with a corn cob, but we'll get to that. Anyway, Andrew's like rolling his eyes because he hasn't really seen very many.
I haven't seen any films. I can tell you that so far, none of the films you've mentioned, with the possible exception of Baz's film, Sounds very family friendly.
No, I think these are all rated NR, actually.
Yeah. I thought Young and Beautiful, I think it's one of Ozone's stronger films in the past few years, but I don't think it's one of his best films. I think it's, I would have been more than happy to watch her, frankly, having sex with people for more than, like, if it was another 20 minutes or so of her. I wouldn't say necessarily specifically that, but just her kind of discovering her own consciousness and her own sense of self, because it's very much an exploration of this woman's own identity, you know, as she hits puberty, as she loses her virginity. I mean, literally, it takes place in four seasons, and starts in summer when she loses her virginity, and by the fall she is like a straight up prostitute. Like, she is charging people 500 euros for
that is true.
You know,
yes.
These little trysts, 300 euros.
I'm glad you were keeping track. That's
it went up and down and things like that, and then and then she's busted for it, and then she's kind of. And then it's very funny because she'll talk about like what babysitters get for their, you know, time. She's like, oh, that's cheap, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, it's very, the way she suddenly becomes very jaded is, I think, somewhat amusing. But I think Ozone said in an interview that he really wanted, it could have been drugs, it could have been alcohol, it didn't necessarily have to be prostitution, but he wanted to tell a story of, a coming-of-age story about a woman who decides to really assert herself in a very provocative way. And it just happens to be prostitution. I thought it was actually quite thoughtful and lovely. But it has a weird cameo by, what's her name? The British actress who's been in Ozone's films before. I'm putting you on the spot.
I don't know. I have no idea. I didn't fall asleep during. Now, right after that was playing in the sidebar. It's not a sidebar. Another section of the competition, En Certain Regard, is The Bling Ring, Sofia Coppola's much anticipated movie about stealing jewelry from Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton.
That's right. Yeah. And that was the opening night of the En Certain Regard. And it also happened a few hours before an actual heist, the Chopard jewels that were stolen from the Sofitel here in town.
You seem to know a lot about this.
Yeah,
robbery,
well, hey, so. They can't pin nothing on me.
I think it was all just an elaborate stunt, publicity stunt, for the Bling Ring.
Yeah, Chopard is actually quite happy because they got a lot of press, and they're also completely insured, so it's not no sweat off their back, off their jewels.
You seem to okay,
but so it's a victimless crime. But Bling Ring is it's hard to criticize Bling Ring for being vapid because it's a story about vapidity and about these shallow teens who get thrills out of. Kind of imposing themselves on celebrities. It's not like they even want to be celebrities. They just want to kind of wear the skin of celebrity. It's very flashy. It's very fun. And it's kind of empty, ultimately. I'm not a huge fan of it, although it's hard to resist its charms.
So, and Emma Watson, of course, is the big star there. And I would say that there was another...
And she pole dances on Paris Hilton's party room.
Note to self.
Yes.
Okay. I will. Yeah. Now that same night we went to see Robin Wright Penn in a film that is playing down the street, down the Croisette, as they say here in France, because that is the name of the street, actually.
And the theaters are on the Croisette, so it's actually legit.
Okay. So,
but Robin Wright would be angry that you're saying Penn because she dropped that after the divorce. So she's just straight up Robin Wright.
we'll take it out in post.
Yeah, exactly.
Ari
Folman, right?
Ari Folman, he did The Congress. Thank you. I could not remember the name of it, and it was...
Oh, yeah, it's not in front of you, sir.
Yes, it's not in front of me. I don't know why it was called The Congress.
It's called The Congress because it was based on a Stanislaw Lem novel called The Futurological Congress, which came out in the late 60s, and was a Polish science fiction about a future that has a population under kind of hallucinogenic control.
Are they all animated in this future?
They certainly are in the movie.
Yes, I've noticed. Because basically half of it's in live action, and the other half is in kind of like Waltzing with Bashir, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's a different type. I think Waltz with Bashir is a much more realistic sort of rotoscoped animation, whereas this is more like Betty Boop and Dick Avery. It's very deliberately cartoonish.
So is it like Roger Rabbit, that sort of mix of
live? No,
no, it doesn't.
Sections.
It's sections.
Sections.
Yeah, it's like, now we're in animation. Like, she snorts a drug, and then suddenly everything goes psychedelic.
Right, and it's about how Robin Wright, the actress, is going to be scanned, if you will.
Exactly.
And then the studio will be able to use her in all sorts of ways. So it would be her quote-unquote last performance. Scathing indictment of Hollywood,
right.
I would say.
Yeah, exactly. But I found it a fascinating premise. I mean, people called it overstuffed with ideas and not completely successful, and there's a certain amount of truth in that. But I really found it quite absorbing, especially that whole conceit that a studio, which doesn't want to be bothered with scandals and tabloid, news reports and drugs and alcohol and things that, and just temperamental talent, decide, you know what, look, we're going to scan you, and we're going to scan not only your body, but we're also going to record you giving a range of emotional reactions so that then we can digitally create performances ad infinitum. You'll never age, and you'll never cause us any bad publicity or fuss. And you'll always go on junkets and be very nice to all the press.
Right.
And
so then shouldn't they have been scanning her ex-husband?
Oh, well, yeah.
had to keep
I think it's a little too late for that. They should have done it when he was Spicoli. But but anyway, yeah, it's an interesting kind of disturbing idea of, entertainment is ones and zeros. We don't need the emotional quotient. That's something we can create. It's a recipe. It's not the mystery of, the human soul and the human condition. And then it goes on from there to a future kind of flash forwards 20 years. And suddenly the studio, which has now been merged with a huge pharmaceutical conglomerate.
Of course.
And seems to have its own army and things like that. Want more from Robin Wright. Because now she's now a huge superstar, action science fiction superstar, which is something the actual Robin Wright would have never done in her career. She always turned down those kinds of roles. Anyway, it's a question about identity, about self-control, about illusion, reality.
Right. Now,
it's a pretty ambitious movie. And again, it may not completely succeed, but I give it complete credit for going for it.
Now, Fruitvale Station was in Cannes.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Sorry, in Sundance. And
it won Sundance.
It won Sundance. Thank you. It's in Cannes here in Uncertain Regard as well. There are two films from China that won in Uncertain Regard called Benz, which is by Flora Lau, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, okay. Which is about a very wealthy Hong Kong resident and her chauffeur who is from mainland China, and basically how their relationship comes together in the car as they're each desperately trying to do something. One is trying to hide the fact that they've lost all their money and their husband, which is the woman, and the chauffeur is trying to get his pregnant wife into Hong Kong to have a second child, which of course is not necessarily allowed in China. So it was kind of a political statement there about what's going on the border between Hong Kong and China and the complexities of that relationship. And then there was...
You're not going to say it with a Chinese accent?
Zhaizhenke.
Zhaizhenke. Zhaizhenke.
Yeah. Which
exactly.
Was a touch of sin. Picked up by Kino Lorber just yesterday.
That's true.
For distribution in the U.S. And this was a scathing indictment. Again, I like using that word. Indictment of China and its current socioeconomic situation. Four stories, an omnibus film.
Based on true stories.
Based on true stories.
Yeah. True crime stories. Things like a
miner who goes ballistic and starts
shooting
up.
And a pedicurist who gets kind of whipped with money and then takes a revenge by knifing the guy.
Right.
And a train accident, suicide at Foxconn factory.
Right. Yeah, so it covers all of those things.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people liked it.
Yeah.
And it's a big question was, would it be released in China? Apparently it is being released in China.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
So it's being released in the fall. Then a film everybody was really looking forward to or kind of anticipated was Asghar Farhadi's film. He is the Iranian filmmaker who did a Separation. He kind of continues the theme here with Le Passé, which is the past.
That's right. Separation, which won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film last year and which was about a divorce happening in Iran. And I think it was a woman who wanted a divorce from a man, and he didn't want to grant it, and then it went to trial and everything like that. And the past is, it's another divorce. It's another situation where the man comes back from Iran, he's married to a French woman, and she wants a divorce. And then, there are quiet revelations and secrets are slowly revealed that, show the complexities of the relationships among all the different players and... I think it's quite sophisticated and But at the same time, I didn't completely love it because I felt somewhat manipulated. You know, it felt like the revelations were being parsed out by this. I felt the hand of the screenwriter quite often while I was watching, and I felt like I was being played around with and toyed with. You know, did you feel that way, or did you like it?
I thought it was okay. I didn't think I thought the ending was kind of contrived, and it overstayed its welcome.
Yeah,
is what I would say.
Yeah.
Now, rather than talk about all the films we've seen, because we've seen, well, I would say over 20.
Yeah, 25 or so.
Let's talk about some of the films we really liked. Miel was a film by...
Miele.
Miele?
Yeah, it's Italian.
Oh, okay. Miele. I'm pronouncing it in Spanish.
That's right, the Spanish, right, Miel.
Yeah, Miele is Valeria Golino, an actress, and I thought it was great. I thought it's one of the strongest films here. I was not expecting a lot. And it's about a woman who helps.
Assisted suicide.
It's a euthanasia film, but not really.
Mm. Well, no, but it is.
It is, but I mean, it's really about her.
It is about her. It's about her discovering that what she feels is a moral, you know,
choice.
That she's making is actually rooted in more kind of more complex emotional reasons that aren't necessarily for, you know, the best things. I mean, it has to deal with her past and her relationship with her own family and everything. But Valeria Golino's an actress who was big in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, for things like, I mean, she was in Rain Man, if you remember, and then she was also in like Hot Shots and Hard Shots Part Deux, is like, you know, as the girlfriend of, you know, what's his name?
Charlie Sheen.
Charlie Sheen, yeah. Yes. Charlie Sheen's, you know, lover.
There's a name you don't hear in Cannes very often. Charlie Sheen.
Yeah. But Valeria Golino's had a much more successful European career. You know, Hollywood's long since kind of
forgotten about
moved all on. But she's still very attractive, and she shows a real talent behind, you know, she has a real eye for direction. This is her first film, and as opposed to a couple other directors who we might mention who are also actors, she's had the certainly the most striking directorial I think film.
Well, the other two actors, and I don't think we should talk about these films. One is James Franco's As I Lay Dying in Un Certain Regard.
Oh, true. Although his is a little more interesting in terms of what he's doing. I mean, he's aspiring to be a good director and trying to do things directorially that are interesting.
With split screen and everything. Yeah. The other is a Castle in Italy by Valeria Brunei Tedeschi, or as I like to say, the film that closed the Quasette. I'm not quite sure why.
It was a madhouse that day. I don't know why.
And the film wasn't all that...
Well, Valerina Bruni Tedeschi is from sort of
royalty,
so to speak. Her sister Carla Bruni is a pop star and also the wife of. Are they still married? Or did they get a divorce?
Why Sarkozy? No, he's no longer president, but they are still married.
Oh, all right.
You just assume he's not president anymore, so they must be divorced.
Well, he divorced to marry her, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
And she'd already been married, I think. But anyway, this is very autobiographical. It's truly her life, and because her family had to sell their castle in Italy.
Right.
There's a little bit of like, you know, rich people problems. There's a line in the film where they say like, oh, the rich, they also cry, you know, and like cry me a river to a certain extent. But yeah, everybody hurts. And, this is an illustration of that. There's some funny moments. There's some sad moments, but they're mostly a lot of dull moments if you ask me.
And so Stephen Garrett there as Michael Stipe, everybody hurts.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Now a film that seems to have be unanimously loved is Inside Llewyn Davis, the latest entry, the latest work by the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan. Everybody loves it. I think you and I both shared the opinion that, yes, it's a solid film, and nobody will see it.
Yeah, I really wonder how marketable it is, which is, of course, ironic considering, or very quite apt, considering that Llewyn Davis is told time and again, I don't know how marketable you are. It's a lovely film, but I keep thinking of it as, you know, I've been saying to people that it's more of a sonata than a symphony. It's a quiet, you know, sort of. It's certainly more than a sketch. It's very fleshed out, but it just feels like a minor film compared with some of the things they've done recently.
You know,
A Serious Man is amazing, yeah. And this is it, weirdly enough, on that same scale, but also strangely enough, I think Serious Man is much going after the big fish, you know,
right,
and the big questions about what life is and who we are and why we are.
And this is going after watching Oscar Isaac, who everybody says gives a great performance as a 1960s pop singer, 1961,
well,
in The Village. He does a great job.
And he's not trained, and he's an amazing vocalist.
Yeah, he did.
And all the performances are done live on camera. I mean, they're not dubbed in later.
Right.
Or they're not syncing to a track that's already been laid down.
Right. So it's about the folk scene and the emergence of the folk scene. Now, let me ask you this, because in the middle of this film, you turned to me and said, I think Spielberg is going to love this. And this was the Japanese film by Koreeda, Like Father, Like Son.
And that's right, yeah. In my very, very superficial reading of Spielberg's priorities, which, you know, seem to be stories about broken homes, fathers and sons not relating or having difficulty relating, or sons looking for father figures or lost sons, you know, things like that.
Right, and it's about two families whose children learn at the age of six, have been switched at birth.
Were switched at birth, yeah, exactly, yeah.
And they didn't know that and how they handled that situation. I like the film.
Well, the hospital basically says, you know, we made a mistake, your kids are the wrong kids, and you need to switch back, and that's where the conflict is. You know, could you actually... Give up the child you've been loving for 6 years and replace it with another child. And, how, you know, it's a nature-nurture thing, and how much of your blood really makes a difference in terms of, you know, being part of a family. And so I thought it was an incredibly provocative idea, and I was very excited as it started and as it revealed its story. But as it went along, it narrowed its focus. It went from being the story about two sets of parents to really just one father who's not a very good father, who realizes how much he needs to step up to be a part of his child's life. And I thought, boring. And then weirdly enough, like the other parents were totally cool with switching the kids, which just seemed bizarrely like a culture thing. I don't know. I guess the
they were also
are much more like there's a line where one of the authorities is like, whenever this happens, there's 100% switch rate. And I was like, really? 100% switch rate? That's messed up. And somebody said, gosh, if Americans made this, there'd be therapists all over this thing.
Like, yeah, that was
counseling.
Me. That was
oh,
me.
I'm sorry. Yeah, yes. And there are no therapists involved because Japanese, I guess, don't like to talk about things. They'd rather kill themselves in honor. Sorry, that's racist. But anyway, so I was a little disappointed by the film.
I want to be somewhat mindful of time and our listeners' time here. So let's talk about just a couple more films. Behind the Candelabra, a film which is a television movie in the United States. It will literally be premiering on HBO, who produced the film, when the Palme d'Or is announced this Sunday.
Oh, that's true. I am.
So the irony is it could win the Palme d'Or. Michael Douglas, who plays Liberace, it's a biopic of Liberace made by Steven Soderbergh. He tried to make the film for years. No studio would finance it. It could win the Palme d'Or, win Michael Douglas a prize. Certainly he would have, I think a lot of people feel, have been nominated for an Oscar if he had.
Oh, easily, yeah, easily.
It is one of the best performances of his career, and yet...
Yeah, and I mean, I think he definitely will get the Emmy this year, and I mean, not to say that it's a sympathy vote because he's a cancer survivor, but it truly is an amazing, amazing performance, and very sympathetic, not broad at all. I mean, there's a risk of getting campy, and they, as outrageous as it gets, it almost never feels anything less than quite loving about their characters.
Right, and it's Liberace and his the last 10 years of his life when he met
Scott Thorson.
Right.
This guy is, I don't think he was a teenager. He must have been in his early
20s. He was 18, actually.
Oh, he was 18, I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. But easily 40 years younger than
yes.
Liberace. And they actually truly fall in love. And the movie has been described as, you know, really about a marriage, you know, even though they weren't married. And it is. I felt like it was very much an Obama-age film about gay marriage.
You know,
where it couldn't have been more familiar, you know, to anybody who's seen a marriage depicted on screen.
Like which Soderbergh, of course, said, well, just was a coincidence, which I would have to agree with.
Well, coincidence that it happens to be the kind of hitting the zeitgeist when it is, because he'd been preparing it for something like 13 years. I mean, he mentioned it to Michael Douglas on the set of Traffic.
Right.
Asked him to do an imitation of Liberace, which he does, of course, brilliantly. But I think he's definitely the front runner for the Best Actor prize here at the festival.
Yes. Now, a film that we both liked, and since we probably shouldn't talk about Only God Forgives, the Nicholas Winding Refn film, which was the first film that I heard here receive solid boos.
Yeah.
Of course, he did Drive here a couple years ago.
Yeah, which got solid Cheers.
Cheers, yeah. Ryan Gosling stars in that film, and it's not even worth discussing right now. All Is Lost, the J.C. Shandor film. Of course, he is the filmmaker behind Margin Call. Robert Redford alone on a sailboat that is stranded, and so is the film.
But it's an interesting exercise.
It is an interesting exercise.
Kudos to him as an actor of his stature and his age, doing such a physical role and almost completely nonverbal. You know, so he's the only actor in the film,
astonishing. Like one or two words in the entire film, and one of them is a profane word, which I went, great, you are now rated R.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. I didn't think about that. Yeah, that's true. But in French, it was putain.
We'll probably have to edit that out now. We'll fix it in post. Don't worry. We're fixing a lot in post these days. But a film that both you and I saw, 2.5 hours long, and a half an hour into it, I think we were both thinking the same thing. And this should probably be the last film we talk about because it's a good note to end on, is this film by Sorrentino.
That's right, Paolo Sorrentino.
Yeah. His last film here was...
It was roundly booed.
Yeah, it was Sean Penn was in it. Sean Penn. Running theme, Sean Penn was in it. This Must Be the Place.
Yeah, he played an aging goth rocker who turns a Nazi hunter in America.
And this was the same year that Lars von Trier was here talking about how he was a Nazi and a Nazi sympathizer. Oh. So that was the running theme there.
Can't escape from the Nazis.
But this year he comes the Great Beauty.
The Great Beauty, yeah. Paolo Sorrentino.
And it starts off, and a half an hour into the film, you're thinking, there is nothing going on in this movie. This movie, there has no plot. I have no idea what this is about. And yet it is unbelievable. I can't take my eyes off of it. I want to know what happens next, even though it doesn't matter what happens next. And you said to me, there's a big giant party scene. You said, this party scene's better than the party scene in The Great Gatsby.
Oh, by far, easily. Oh my God, so much more life and vim and verve and I don't know. I mean, it was just amazing. And it's funny because the movie starts with about 5 minutes of these tourists, Japanese tourists, looking at Roman ruins. So it's quite an ode to Rome. It's very much a movie about Rome, and it's his riff on La Dolce Vita. It's the same ideas of
very Fellini-esque in a way.
And it's hard, you know. I was like, on the one hand, if you address these themes, it's hard not to be Fellini-esque. On the other hand, you know, if you're Italian, maybe it's just in your blood to be outrageous this way. It's so charmingly chaotic.
It made me think, I've got to go to a few parties in Italy, because if those are the parties, I'll go.
Oh, my God. So this party scene, there's this little prologue last maybe 5 minutes or so, but then there's this party scene with literally no dialogue. It's just thumping techno music and the most, like, outrageous people dancing around and writhing and laughing, and it's just hypnotic for like a good 15 or 20 minutes.
Yes, and you think...
And you never want it to end. It's so good.
Yes, it's unbelievable. It really is. Now, what I've noticed is the European critics here have not liked it as much as the Americans. The Americans think it's great, it's fantastic, it's artistic, and the Europeans are saying, Fellini.
Well, it's, Sorrentino has such a great visual eye, such flair, and such a way of using camera. He's almost always shooting widescreen, so it's such a treat to see his movies anyway, I think. I mean, even This Must Be the Place had its pleasures.
You called it a fine tailored suit.
It really is. And there was another critic in Guardian called it couture cinema. You know, it's so perfectly cut. You know, you just feel like this Northern Italian artisanal craftsmanship, you know, even though it is set in Rome. But there's a sense of, the finest elegance, that only an Italian can make. You know, it's really... It's incredible, but the story is, I think there is a story.
Eventually there is a story, yes.
No, it comes in pretty quickly. I mean, it's 2.5 hours, so it takes a time to,
Quickly is relative here in Cannes.
Well, Tony Servillo is a great Italian actor who's been in a lot of movies here, and been in a lot of Sorrentino's movies. He was in El Divo, he plays a...
An author.
Like a one-time author. He wrote a novella like decades before, which gave him a certain amount of literary acclaim, and he just kind of squanders it, over a life of just partying and kind of maybe not fluffy journalism, but he's a journalist. He's not writing for a tabloid, but he's basically decided that instead of actually writing another book, he would just interview people and write articles, about Roman culture. But there's a sense of decadence, existential despair, spiritual, you know, rootlessness, quite literally, right? Because that becomes a theme that comes in at the end. But there are the Fellini-esque touches of, you know, beautiful, voluptuous women and, you know, a dwarf editor who's hilarious and actually quite full-fleshed character. What else? Performance art, a little girl who paints paintings for millions of dollars. I mean, all these things you would totally find in something that Fellini would make in the 60s, you know?
Yeah. Yes, that's very, very true.
And it's fantastic. It's so intoxicating and then also quite despairing in its own way.
And it's the kind of film, in my opinion, you could watch again and get something even more out of it. You can actually get something more out of it.
Yeah.
Well, now...
So I have a question, if I can. Every year... Some of the films that you see at Cannes end up on your top 10 list, really close to it. Mm. So have you seen, so name the films who you think are the good candidates to make your top 10 for the year.
Yeah, I would say the Sorrentino.
Yes.
Great Beauty, Llewyn Davis. Gosh, maybe that's where it ends. I think this has been an okay year. I don't think it's been an amazing year, but I don't think it's been an awful year
Do you
either.
Think the Chinese film A Touch of Sin?
I don't know if it would be on my list, but... You know,
when we still have some films to
come. We have Nebraska coming up.
That's true, which is by Alexander Payne, and The Immigrant by James Gray, and a Jim Jarmusch film. And then, of course, Venus in Fur by Roman Polanski. So that's still to come. Who do you think at this point, if you were to guess?
Handicap
the Palme d'Or, because, of course, that's what you have to do when you're in Cannes.
Yeah.
It's like, what's your major?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you're in college, that's what you say at a party.
Well, you know, I would say the wild card is Spielberg, who... you know, as talented as he is, I never really think of as a cineast the way that I do somebody like Scorsese or Coppola or some of the others, just because Spielberg has so relentlessly worked in Hollywood, which is a discredit to Spielberg. I'm sure he's actually a lot more astute about international cinema, but it's hard to guess what it would be. I can see the past getting something just because Farhadi's having a moment now. You know, he's won... The
Oscar, I think that was...
He won the top prize at Berlin before winning the Oscar for the same film. I think his career is definitely a worthy recognition. So whether or not they want to make him a Palme d'Or winner or maybe just the winner of the Grand Jury Prize or the screenplay, possibly, because people do admire the script as much as I've kind of poo-pooed it. Let's see, Corrida, possibly, you know, if we want to be superficial and
like father, like son.
Armchair psychology. Behind the Candelabra could be a sentimental favorite, even though Soderbergh's already won. But then there's a question of, like, do you want to make him a two-time Palme d'Or winner? The same goes for Llewyn Davis. Like, is this the film that, you know, the Coens deserve to get the Palme d'Or for the second time?
When they received it for Barton Fink in 1994, I want to say?
No, I think it was 91. Something like that.
Somewhere in there, yeah. Somewhere, yeah. You're right.
Actually. 90 or 91.
You're right, yes.
You know, and they've had 8 movies in competition, so, you know. Sorrentino would be a pleasant surprise.
It would be. I would. That would be a one. It's like I compared it to this year's Holy Motors.
Yeah.
It's a crazy film. You have no idea why you loved it, but you just did.
Have we seen Best Actress yet? Have we seen any performance?
Not that I know of. No. I mean, maybe for Young and Beautiful, but I can't imagine.
Yeah, she's so young though.
She's so young and pretty much. Yeah, it's a. And, you know, it's a performance of no consequence that I could see.
Yeah, I don't really see that. Maybe the woman from A Touch of Sin, who's Zsa Zsenkó's wife, who's been in a lot of his movies.
That's true.
So I could see that happening.
That is true.
I mean,
or
Kristen
the
Scott
Benz.
Thomas. But,
eh. Yeah, Kristen Scott Thomas was in Only God Forgives. I can't imagine. Well, maybe we'll see. We'll see.
And it could be the movie tonight, the Kashisha film, Blue is the Warmest Color, which is a 3-hour lesbian drama. So there you got two girls.
Well, I have to be honest with you. I had no idea that was the name of the film, Blue is the Warmest Color, because everybody has been referring to it solely as the 3-hour lesbian movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody has actually referred to it by name.
Which is very typical of Cannes. It could be The Immigrant. It could be Marion Cotillard, who hasn't won here.
Good point.
For her performances yet. And it could be Emmanuel Seigner for Venus in Fur. So, and it could be Tilda Swinton for the Jarmusch film that comes on Saturday. So I think I guess what I'm saying is it looks like the strong female performances are coming in the end stretch there in the last 3 or 4 days of the festival.
Now, everybody has a different Cannes experience.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Except Berenice Bejo in the past could win it.
Ah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Although I think the fact that neither of us spoke about her, I think, speaks volumes, which is that it's certainly competent, but nothing remarkable.
Yes. Kind of like the Tedeschi film. Now,
oof, yeah.
Now, you know, Stephen, you and I were having a conversation, and I know you have to run, and then we're going to turn our attention to Andrew, but about how everybody who comes to Cannes, there are so many different Cannes experiences. There's some people who spend their time out on the yachts and the boats, which, of course, back in my younger years, I never did. And now in my later years, I'm still not doing. there are the people who just go to parties. There are the people who are here for the market. And so, you know, I would say we're having one experience. Andrew, thank you very much for taking the time
to
speak
thank
with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Andrew,
I hope we weren't too, like, boring or pedantic.
No, it's interesting to hear, interesting to hear you talking about them because...
Blah, blah. These movies are bad. No.
Yeah. Actually, for the first time, I was actually going to start counting iPhones. In movies.
Oh my God, so many iPhones in movies. And just plot devices or, you know.
Yes, I was also going to start counting the number of times we heard blah, 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 where they actually spell out or say blah, 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 and you don't really need to subtitle that because it's blah, blah, blah.
That's pretty funny, yeah.
It's actually become, that Seinfeldism has actually...
Well, excuse me, that was yada, 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 but that's very specifically New York.
So. Yes, that's true.
Maybe the translation of yada, yada, yada is blah, blah, blah.
Then we need subtitles.
Yeah, we need subtitles for that. Anyway, but I'll exit.
Okay.
Yeah?
You're going to exit screen left.
Screen left, stage left, exit, chased by bear. but now I will listen to you guys. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you.
Now, okay, so that brings us to the reason Andrew is here. Now, Andrew, you are as we mentioned earlier, a producer from Australia, but from Texas, Wild Pure Heart Productions. What does Wild Pure Heart Productions do? What is its core focus?
So we've done a feature film a few years ago called Finding Joy, and we've done a couple of documentaries, including one called 7 Days with 7 Dogs, where we took our 7 rescued dogs on the trip of a doggy lifetime.
Really? You've rescued 7 dogs?
Oh, we've rescued more than that, but we had 7 at the time.
Wow, that right there... is a Cannes film, or at least a Sundance film. I mean, that's a...
One hopes so. In fact, when I left home, there were 11 rescued cats, and at the moment, there are 18 rescued cats. They've taken on some more while I was here.
Have you seen the film? It wasn't here in Cannes or at Sundance. We bought a zoo.
Yeah.
Because
that was a good one.
Because it's...
It was sweet. And there's another film that I saw on the market called The Zookeeper about a guy. I believe he just starts a zoo in his backyard.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. And so you saw that in the market here.
That's correct. Not I didn't actually see the film, but I spoke with the sales agent, and they that's one of the films that they were selling.
Now you're here as a producer attending the market. So there's two sides to Cannes. There's the artsy side, if you will, and that's the
well. There's the side that actually watches movies,
right? And that's really the festival in competition, that's and down right. at the Kazan or the Director's Fortnight or the Critics Week. And then there's the side, the commerce side, if you will. Which is all about buying and selling movies to distributors and raising money to make movies.
That's correct.
And so this is your first time in Cannes.
That's right. I've come with a group of 10 people from Canberra, which is Australia's nation capital. I'm in that area. And all but one of us have never been to the market before or to Cannes before. And so it was quite an eye-opener for those of us who actually want to bring more films out into the world.
And so did you have a specific agenda when you...
Yes, I sure did. I sure did. So I've got a film that has gotten to a certain stage of its development, and it's still relatively early as far as films go in the process. It doesn't have any financing attached, not any cast attached. But what I was trying to do was talk with sales agents, and mainly sales agents, and find the kinds of people who would look at the kind of film that I want to make. So... one of the things that I did was walk through the many, many halls and the many, many stalls of the market, which takes place in 3 large areas in the Palais.
Right.
And just look at the posters on the wall. And if the poster featured an axe dripping blood, I knew that was probably not for me.
No, that's a vampire distributor.
Yeah exactly. You'd be a lot of that kind of stuff. So if there's a prominent display of blood, probably not for me. And so, you know, there are around 12,000... buyers, sellers, producers, all these sorts of people who are in the commerce side of the business trying to find the people who to buy their film or to sell their film for them. And of those, for a filmmaker like me, there might be, you know, maybe a couple hundred who would be relevant to what I'm trying to do at my stage in the career and that sort of thing. So the trick is to find those needles in the haystack. And most people set up their meetings before they actually get here, so they'll know who they're targeting and they'll know who they're trying to sell, and you're not just wasting someone's time walking up to them and going, "I've got an animation," and you know they only do horror. So you try to target who you're talking to so that everyone is getting good value for the time. There was a sales agent, Simon Crow of SC Films, who spoke to our group, and he said that it costs him £250 to have a meeting here in Cannes.
Why is that? So that's £250 just to do the conversion would be about $3.5 million. So given the exchange rate these days, but it's expensive. So, but why does it cost so much money?
Right. So, is it extremely expensive to have an apartment to act as an office here in Cannes during the week?
So if you're not in the Palais, you have an apartment somewhere.
Right. Or if you're in the Palais, you'll have a stand there. And most, you know that those aren't exactly free in a box of Cracker Jacks.
No, they're actually quite expensive. And you have to, contractually, you have to man it all the time. Mm. And you have to be there until Friday. So you have to be there like essentially 9 days.
That's right. And today is Wednesday, before that Friday. And already even yesterday, the intensity of the market has really started to fade. So there are people on their stands, but maybe not necessarily the people that you want to speak to.
That's right.
So I didn't actually know that part of it. They're actually obligated to have it 20, the entire hours of the thing for that long. But certainly the buzz of activity is fading.
Yes, that is. And, I've talked to a couple of, whether they're, software vendors or there aren't too many of those, but a couple.
Actually, there were at least three video on demand platforms. There was,
right.
There was an interesting one that was very, very tightly integrated with Facebook that would allow you to watch the movie in Facebook and use the Facebook social graph to promote your film. There was another one that was...
Do you remember the name of that?
Sure, absolutely. It was CineClick, CineClick.
Okay.
And then there was another one that was FilmSoul, and they had a very different approach where they would you would host your movies on their site. There's many of these popping up. I didn't see Distrify here, but that's another one that created by Glaswegian.
Right.
And so these platforms are all kind of trying to figure out what's the space. I also attended a number of sessions that were presented either for the newer producers. The Cannes, for the third year, has run a series of workshops called, it's called the Producers Workshop.
Right.
And so they're specifically targeting first-time Cannes film market attendees or people who are more or less maybe newer to the industry. And they had half a dozen sessions over the first 3 days, including the day before the market.
Wow.
Very solid, very solid sessions. I also attended a series of four panels put on by Film Finance TV in association with Screen International. And again, four very solid sessions talking about the business of it, co-productions, financing for the international market, pitching to an international thing. How do you do that well? And one of the things that was very interesting was just to get that sort of nuts and bolts look at, this is a business. It is show business. You hear that often.
Right.
And that's your business is show business. And the idea that, for example, I've heard several times people saying it's much easier to finance a $100 million film than a $25 million film.
Right. Well, that's the old Steven Soderbergh, he in his State of the Cinema address said the same thing.
Which is recent.
Yes.
Which is recent. And also there was, similarly, it's probably easier to finance a $1 million film than a $25 million film. So that middle ground has been squeezed out. And that idea that the studios are wanting to make their franchise films and their tentpole films and the films where they know they're going to make a ton of money. And at the other end, you've got the films that don't cost all that much.
But that they still have to spend $25 million to market.
For sure. But at the same time, if you're making a film for $1 million as opposed to $25 million, you have to make a lot less money to make that a profitable venture. And one of the things that they were saying as a trend, and these were the financiers talking, was that because the studios are making fewer films, but the stars still want to act, there's an opportunity for indie filmmakers to attach bigger name cast for much lower money because they want to act and they still need to be on the screen. So you can put together a package that has better name, maybe even a better writer. Someone who might have made $750,000 or $1 million is not making that anymore, or at the moment anyway. So they, you know, again, the financier is talking, squeezing those elements down into a more financeable package, and therefore making more money.
Right. That seems to be a common theme. You know, everything's getting squeezed, specifically because of, well, I don't want to say VOD, but more the internet on demand. Netflix models, they don't pay as much.
Yeah, well, it's that you hear, I've heard it over and over, the analog dollars being traded for digital dimes, and they haven't figured that out.
Right.
And so for low-end filmmakers, and that's where I'm at the moment, you know, there's an opportunity there, because if I can bring in I don't love to make $100 million on a film, maybe that will happen, but I don't, if I'm making a film for around $1 million, I don't have to make the $100 million to make it worthwhile. I mean, Michael's always talking about that. If you can double the cost of your film in theaters, you know, you're well on your way to having a profitable venture.
Yeah, I mean, I think for anybody who is interested in the economics behind why studios are making $160 million movies or spending that much money to get there, that Steven Soderbergh talk where he explains why it is they'll spend $100 million to make a movie instead of $25 million, in which they still have to make $170 million. Yeah, I mean,
That's exactly right.
It's a really interesting talk and very candid.
And it's about risk aversion.
Right.
You know, if $100 million is more money than most people will ever see in their life. $1 million, for that matter, is more money than most people will ever see in their lives. But if you're going to spend $100 million, or if you're probably more accurately, if you're going to be the person who's putting up the $100 million or a chunk of it, you want to know that you're going to see your money again. And so the star, the director, the script that looks like it's commercial is all about how can we assure our investors that they'll see their money back.
Right. And I guess that's, so you've been spending a lot of time this week thinking about that.
That's right, for sure. So for example, in my film, I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm not going to have that kind of budget. That's okay. But is there some way I could do maybe some stunt casting or something just for small elements of it so that there's something for the marketing people to hold on to?
Well, let me ask you this. I know that we keep hearing, and you mentioned it, you're talking to sales agents.
Yes.
The Palais is filled with sales agents. What does
from around the world.
From all over the world.
If you like movies from Thailand, or if you want to make a film in Jordan, or if you want to buy a film that's got a huge star, or if you want to buy a film that was a credit card film, it's all here.
Right. So what, just to fill our listeners in on, what does a sales agent do?
Okay. So the two concepts that you'll often hear are sales agent and distributor. Sales agents are the ones who will take on the movie and then sell it out into the various territories around the world.
So you have a movie.
That's right.
And I'm going to be a sales agent.
That's right. And so, you're going to sell the rights to it to, you know, the various parts of Europe, to the various countries, US, Australia, New Zealand, and each of, you know, there's 100 and I believe roughly 150, 170 territories that the world is divided up into. And what you're trying to do is sell to as many of those as you can, knowing that there are some issues. So for example,
this is both before the film is made and after the film is made. It's a little bit easier. Well, I don't know. Is it easier to do it after the film is made? I guess because there's people here buying movies that they're watching.
Sure. And a lot of the sales agents said to me, we only look at stuff once it's made. Whereas other sales agents like to come in early in the process and maybe even have a hand in the crafting of the script. So different sales agents like to work in different ways. There are issues then that the sales agents have to face. For example, one of the sales agents I was talking to said that characters with beards don't go over well in Japan.
Okay.
Or in China, the government doesn't like films that feature a lot of magic. And so there are characteristics that the sales agents have to know about each of those territories and how you sell into them. And then the sales agents will also often be part of the package that's put together so that the film can actually get made. So if I have a distributor in Australia, so the distributors are usually the people who get the movie out in a particular territory. So in my case, it'd be Australia.
So logistically, they're the ones making prints, not
That's
anymore.
Right.
They're the ones duplicating hard drives and getting them into movie theaters.
That's right, and making sure that the poster design is right, and
right.
You know, working with the publicity machine and doing the plan that's going to get this film successful in a local market. So the sales agents sell to typically the distributor.
Okay.
That's sort of in a broad brushstroke how
yes.
that works. But both the distributor and the sales agents are part of the package that a producer tries to put together, to get their film up. Because who pays for these things? Well, in the United States, it's typically private equity, or you have a deal with your sales agent, and maybe they might put some money up into as part of the budget for the film. In non-U.S. countries, Australia included, the governments are often very strongly involved in the film industry.
So the sales agent, before a film is made,
will say, I like the look of that.
Here's some money.
I'm going to get involved. Well, these days, that here's some money part is getting harder and harder. One sales agent said to the group that I came with today, the number right now is zero. But that doesn't
mean... So is that a hard zero? And what is the exchange rate on that?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But that doesn't mean that there's no value. Because if I can, let's say I'm able to attach a sales agent and a distributor to my package, then I can go to the various funding bodies and say, look, these guys are interested. They're going to take it on. So you guys can help me finance this thing. It's not a total crapshoot. And so the financing of a film is a jigsaw puzzle. It's very unusual to have only two financing partners in a movie. Let's say you're making a European movie.
No, I mean, if the kind of a joke here in Cannes, when you watch these movies that are in competition or down at the director's fortnight or in the critics week, is you have the festival logo play, which has been the same festival logo for as long as I can remember, 15, 20 years. And then you have the production company logos, one after the other. And sometimes there's 10, 15 of these production logos,
right.
Production company logos. And it's by the fifth or sixth or seventh one, people start laughing.
Right.
Because it's kind of funny.
Yeah, it is. But it's a reflection of the reality of the industry. If you're, say, doing a co-production, like an official co-production between four European countries or something like that, and many of the countries have treaties with each other, which is, you know, legislation that says, okay, these rules govern these official co-productions between these two countries. So Australia has about a dozen co-production treaty partners, including the UK, Ireland, Canada. I believe there's one for South Africa, those sorts of things. And what happens is that there are some concessions made because everyone wants – it's a valuable thing to have a movie made in your country. It's
right.
a valuable thing.
And which is why here in Cannes you have the International Village.
That's right.
Which has, I don't even know how many.
Several dozen countries. You know, pretty much every country that's serious about it is represented here in Cannes, either in the International Village or, for example, the Australian office is just across the Croisette from the Palais.
Yes, and you can find it, follow the thumping techno music. It's right there. That's every night I think, wow, those Australians are having fun.
Yeah, some of them really are. But it's not unusual to have 20 financing partners in a feature film. So, you know, this chunk comes from that government. That chunk comes from this region within that country because that region has an incentive that's in addition to what maybe the federal government of that country is. So, for example, I live in New South Wales, but I also live near Canberra, which is the nation's capital of Australia, which is, if you were to draw an arc from Sydney to Melbourne, it's about halfway. So I'm kind of in the overlap of two regions. So in theory, I'm not saying this will happen, but in theory, I could conceivably get the ACT, the Australian Capital Territory government, to help me with my film. I could, in theory, get the government of New South Wales to help me get the finance together for my film. Not get it together, but that there's some money that can go toward production. Because I live rurally in New South Wales, so I live kind of in the middle of nowhere, there's some money that's targeting rural filmmaking in New South Wales. They're trying to get movies made outside of Sydney. And then Australia also has a tax offset, so you can get a certain percentage of the budget back from the Australian federal government if you tick off the boxes and have qualifying Australian production spend and all that sort of stuff.
So right, so if you hired a cinematographer from Australia and you've spent a certain amount of money in Australia, then you get, it's called soft money.
That's exactly right, because
right.
it's government money. So again, there's this jigsaw of finance that comes together to make these things happen, even at the lower end of the film, much less the higher end of the film.
Right. Now for those, and that's before the film is made.
That's right.
For those filmmakers and producers who come here with a film that they've made.
With a dream.
But yes.
Or a dream that's been edited together.
But yeah, realized on celluloid or digital or whatever it is these days. And so those sales agents are effectively hawking a product.
Or it could be the producer who's walking around with, as part of the group that I've come with, there's two completed films that the guys were just wandering around trying to find compatible sales agents. And the response that you're hoping to get from them is something along the lines of, I'd like to see that. Do you have a screener? Can I see it? So they were handing out screeners. And again, it's a bit like a matchmaking, because you've got to find someone who's compatible with what you're trying to do, who sells the kind of film. So, it's like we said before, if you have a sales agent who mainly does horror, there's no point in giving them your animation.
Or your romantic comedy.
That's right. Exactly right. That's badly targeted. You're wasting their time.
And so your first trip to Cannes, is it what you expected?
I actually have no idea how to answer that question, because it, at some level it's overwhelming. Just sheer volume of people, the sheer volume of commerce that goes on here is staggering. One of the panels that I went to, if you counted up the gross box office receipts of the people who were sitting in the panel, it would have been in the billions. And so that, you know, there's so much going on here. In terms of what I expected, it's really I think that might almost be a bit like asking a woman who's just given birth for the first time if it was what she expected. It's like you can't fathom what it's really going to be like. Or raising a family, you know. No one can tell you what it's really like, because you have to go through the experience. To me, it's a bit like that.
Well, and so what has been something that you're going to take away that you think, I'm glad I went because...
That one's easy. I'm glad I've come, because I've made some really good contacts with people I would never have made contacts before. I've had quite a bit of interest in the concept that I have, and to have walked away with, you know, half a dozen or so people who'd like to see the script from me at the stage that my film is at is an excellent, excellent result. But more than that, just to understand the scope of the ocean and how small a drop you are in that ocean is both sobering, but also, you know what, you can cluster in a little bit of water and have some success, not necessarily have to drink the whole ocean.
Right, and I guess anybody that's interested in this world of the market and the film market and international film financing, there's a film here in Cannes called Seduced and Abandoned. It's by James Toback, the filmmaker James Toback, who comes to Cannes with Alec Baldwin to finance a movie about, it's basically Last Tango in Iraq. It's a remake of Last Tango in Paris, but in Iraq. And they did this last year. They shot it last year. And I found it interesting because it's made in Cannes and I'm watching it in Cannes. So that might be why. It's going to appear on HBO, but it's playing out of competition here. I know some people feel like it goes over the same territory that you already know, but if you don't know it, it's interesting.
For sure.
And so I would recommend that film, and certainly you leave the festival when?
I'm leaving tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
So today's really my last day. And again, as I said before, it really feels to me like the market side of the festival really has, it's winding down, so it's okay to leave.
Yes, indeed. In fact, we should probably leave our listeners here, and thank you guys for listening. You can, of course, follow us on, I have to remember all of our closing lines here, which is that you can email us, right? dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. What is our phone number? It's 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Do you know what
I've heard you say this so often. Michael Giltz can be found at michaelgiltz.com. Jay Sperling Wright can be found at Celluloid Junkie. Their website is showbizsandbox.com. And, of course, there's the Facebook page.
That's true. And I guess it's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. We're also on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is the our username there. And Andrew, thank you for joining us and for listening to Stephen and I blather on for so long.
It's been a thrill to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
I guess maybe we'll leave our listeners with this. Stephen and I, we've seen maybe 20, 25 films over the course of 1 week. How many films have you seen coming to Cannes for your first time attending the market?
Zero.
And that is what I mean by everybody has a different Cannes experience. Until next time, play nice.